Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
She rubbed her eyes to clear her vision. "Come on, let's get some breakfast made so we can go sliding. I think we're going to the hill by Chester Creek. But first, I have to get dressed. You scoot to your rooms and have Daddy get you ready. I'll see you downstairs in a few minutes." Deidre hurriedly brushed her teeth and combed her hair. No need to be too fastidious to go sliding with two little girls. For the rest of the day, she left her troubles behind and lost herself in the fun they were having. Time passed too quickly. At 6 in the evening, she left Ben's for her wilderness cabin, but not before squeezing Megan and Marin tightly. Before she drove away, she and Ben hugged briefly, the way friends do. By 8 o'clock, she was home, had the fire kindled, and was ready for bed. Tomorrow, she would try to relax. The next day was work. As she was falling asleep and in a dream state, she felt Ben in bed beside her. She woke with a start to find she had her arms wrapped around her spare pillow. She fluffed it into shape and placed it under her head. She dreamed of Megan and Marin, not a good dream, but a frustrating dream in which she was trying to shield them from an unknown danger. What was so frustrating was that she couldn't identify what it was. Chapter 7. On Monday, Deidre followed her familiar routine, getting ready for work, and traveled into Silver Bay. She drove across the bridge under which the body had been found. It had snowed 3 inches while she was in Duluth on Friday night, and a snowplow had come through with its blade down and had rolled back a windrow of snow, scraping the bridge deck clean. "That takes care of any evidence we may have missed," she thought. She stopped her car, got out, and looked over the railing. The river was frozen more than it had been. Only a narrow channel was still open in the middle. The fresh snow covered everything, erasing all signs of the tragedy that had occurred. Deidre wished that the ills of humankind could be so easily obliterated. She stood staring from the bridge for several minutes before getting back in her car and driving to her office in the police station. After checking messages, Deidre took a ride around town. It was a sleepy day. Gray clouds blanketed the sky, and a few tardy townspeople were clearing snow from their driveways. There was no wind, and smoke rose straight out from chimneys in the crisp November air. It took her an hour and a half to make her rounds. Ascertaining that all was well, she returned to the station. A fax was waiting for her in the machine on a stand in the corner of the room. She picked it up and thumbed through the pages, 4 of them. To Deidre Johnson, BCA investigator. From Dr. Judith Koster, forensic anthropologist / examiner. Regarding Jane Doe, recovered in Silver Bay, November 20th. The year was smudged, so it was illegible. The following report concerns an examination of a young girl's corpse found frozen under a bridge in Silver Bay, Minnesota. The body was discovered by Officer Deidre Johnson of the Silver Bay Police Force on Wednesday, November 13th, at approximately 7:30 a.m. She notified the BCA at 8:45 a.m., requesting the help of an investigator and a medical examiner. Both arrived at 1 p.m., and the body was removed from the scene at 1:51 p.m. It was found to be frozen from exposure to the elements for a minimum of 9 hours. The core temperature at the time of removal from the scene was 47 degrees Fahrenheit. The outer layers of skin and deeper flesh of the extremities were deeply frozen. The extremities could not be manipulated. The body was not allowed to thaw during transport to Two Harbors, and the examiner accompanied the body the entire trip. The Lake County Search and Rescue Team arrived in Two Harbors at 2:34 p.m., at which time the deceased was transferred to a gurney and moved to the confines of the morgue, where it was allowed to slowly thaw over the next 18 hours. The examiner made observations during that time. Below are her findings listed chronologically as the body was able to be manipulated as it thawed. November 13, 3 p.m. The nude body of what appears to be a post-pubescent female is curled into a tight fetal position with knees drawn up to chest and arms wrapped around its thorax. Hair is black, shoulder length, and appears to be natural color. There appear to be no puncture wounds consistent with gunshot or stabbing. The face is badly bruised. The upper lip is swollen, and a 3-centimeter gash follows the upper left lip line. A 5-centimeter hematoma is clearly visible under the corpse's right eye. Upper arms are covered with contusions, and hematoma 6 centimeters in diameter is evident on the left buttock. The upper thighs show evidence of bruising. The body was returned to a cooler kept at a constant temperature of 40 degrees Fahrenheit. November 13th, 4 p.m. The victim's eyelids could be retracted. Upon examination, the sclera was found to have numerous petechiae, indicative of manual strangulation. The limbs are not able to be extended, and the body is still in a curled fetal position. Deidre continued to read the hourly recordings, many of them reiterating that the body remained too curled on itself to make further evaluation possible. The notation for the 1 a.m. observation said that the girl's body was beginning to thaw to the point where the fingers and hands could be manipulated. Judy noted that she was able to procure scrapings from under the corpse's fingernails, but upon gross examination, she could see no signs of skin or other evidence. As she read on, the report seemed to be a macabre script for a horror movie. The problem, Deidre was all too aware, was that she was reading about a real-life incident and a human being whose life had been traumatically taken from her. Finally, she reached the time that she and Melissa had joined Judy, and Deidre recognized the report of what had been observed by the three women. Following the hourly log she compiled while the body thawed, Dr. Koster, Judy, attached several more findings to the report. Deidre read more. A blood sample was tested using the ABO system, and the subject is type O. Deidre remembered the statistics Judy had quoted at the morgue. Nearly 80% of Indigenous people were of that type. One more minuscule clue for her to add to her meager list. The report continued. After further review of the victim's dental condition, it was found that her third molars, parentheses wisdom teeth, were nearing the point of eruption, indicating her probable age as between 16 and 18. Her dental condition was excellent, with no trace of having worn braces. The upper left first premolar has an amalgam filling, as does the lower right second molar. The most pronounced anomaly is that her permanent lateral incisors are missing, and the gap they would have left is filled by a shift forward of the posterior teeth. The epiphyseal plates of the distal and proximal ends of her radii are not ossified. Neither is the medial end of the humerus. It was noted that the distal end of the humerus was in the late stages of ossification, a process that occurs at approximately 16 years of age in females. The victim has straight, naturally black hair. Her skin appears to be of a darker shade, as are her nipples, areolae, and peritoneal skin. She has ample eyelashes, also black, and shaped eyebrows with evidence, signs of eyebrow plucking, that at one time her brows nearly met over her nose. X-ray analysis of her bone structure revealed the absence of supracondyloid processes, a bony growth found anterior on the humerus. Its presence would have indicated the bone of a Caucasian. X-rays taken from differing angles of that bone reveal that it is somewhat flattened in cross-section. Taken individually, each factor is not definitive. However, taken collectively, indications are that the victim was a 16-year-old Native American female. From the data and from the geographical location of where the body was found, the tribe to which she belonged might theoretically be Cree. Deidre used a yellow marker to highlight areas of the report she would return to for more thought. On a page separate from the report was a note from Judy. Deidre, when I returned to the Twin Cities, I was so emotionally involved with this case that I couldn't take the weekend off. An assistant and I stayed in the lab until we finished enough of the exam to enable me to make a preliminary report. More info will be coming as I discover more about this girl. Go catch whoever did this. Judy. By the time Deidre had read the report and pondered some of its implications, straightened her desk, and filed the report for the day, it was nearly 3:30, close to quitting time. She heard the outer door to the station open and heard someone stamping snow off boots. She came around her desk to meet whoever would be opening the inner door. "Dan," she greeted the officer for whom she was filling in. "Good to see you, and no sling. That must be a good sign." Dan grinned from ear to ear, all healed and ready to go. "Actually, I've been going stir crazy having to stay inside with nothing to do. I wasn't supposed to walk on slippery surfaces until I was healed up. They're afraid I'd slip and fall and tear things up again. I'm sorry you got tangled up in such a mess, but on the other hand, I'm relieved I was away. You've got far better connections than I do to handle this sort of case." "Then you know of my recent hire by the BCA?" she asked. He plopped into an office chair. "I'm more than happy. I'm just a small town cop, content doing what I do. I'll be here to help you any way I can, but believe me, I know this is way out of my league. From what I hear, you have some pretty big guns backing you up. Go to it with my blessings." This was exactly what Deidre had hoped for, but she hadn't been sure how Dan would react. She poured a cup of coffee for both of them and sat down in another chair, not the one behind Dan's desk. Dan spoke first. "I feel so good, Deidre, and restless. Is there any way I can come in tomorrow? You could help me get up to speed on what else has happened while I've been out. Maybe we could even ride around in the patrol car a bit, just to let me get my feet wet." Deidre beamed. "That's an offer I can hardly refuse. 7 tomorrow morning? Let me ask you this. If you feel comfortable being back, is there any chance I could take off at noon? I've got a couple of things I'd like to do tomorrow away from town." "I think I could manage that," Dan said, his eyes sparkling at the thought of being back on the job. His job. Chapter 8. Deidre could hear the rush of feet from inside when she rang the doorbell. "Deidre's here. She's here, Dad." She didn't wait for them to answer the door. When she walked in, Megan and Marin threw themselves into her arms, smothering her with kisses. "Are you staying with us tonight?" they asked in unison. Deidre continued to hug them. "I sure am. Maybe we can play a game tonight before your bedtime. What would you think of that?" She placed them on the floor, and the girls ran upstairs to their room. "I want to play checkers," Marin announced. "No, let's play Old Maid." Deidre could hear them arguing even after they had cleared the top of the stairs. She looked up to see Ben standing in the kitchen doorway, a smile on his face. "Well, it's obvious who counts around this house," he scolded, but with a laugh. Deidre went over to him and gave him a hug. He was almost a foot taller than she and had to stoop to get his arms around her. "I'm glad you called this morning. It was good to hear your voice. Glad we can spend a few hours together before you have to leave for the cities. Did you bring Pete along? I'm always happy to put him up for a day or two, and the girls love him. They treat him like a person, and he doesn't complain a bit." The evening was what Deidre needed, providing her a diversion from the task ahead. The four of them played Old Maid and Chinese checkers, laughing and teasing each other. At 8 o'clock, Ben announced that it was bedtime for the little girls, and amid much whining and cajoling, he and Deidre ushered them off to bed. Deidre tucked in one, then the other, kissed them on their foreheads, and quietly closed their bedroom door. As she and Ben tiptoed down the stairs, they heard, "Good night, Daddy. Good night, Deidre. See you in the morning," followed by giggles and then silence. When they were alone downstairs, Ben poured each of them a glass of wine, and they took their usual places at each end of his couch. Deidre took a sip of her wine before she said anything. "I love those girls like they were my own. I find myself thinking about them so often, wondering what they're doing, if they miss their mom, if they'll remember her when they're older." She took another sip and wiped away a tear that rolled down her cheek. "They were so young when she died." Ben rotated his wine glass in his hand. "They talk about her, but I don't know how much they remember. Sometimes I think what they think they remember is actually coming from the pictures I have sitting around." "And you, Ben, what about you? Are you finding your way?" Deidre looked at his face. "It's getting better, easier. This is a new normal. We are getting used to it. But I do miss Jenny." Ben and Deidre sat in silence, nursing what was left of their wine. Finally, Deidre took one last swallow and got up. "We'd better get some sleep. You have work, and I have a trip to Minneapolis in the morning. Good night, Ben, and thanks for all you're giving me." She rinsed out their glasses while Ben collected the games they had played. Together they climbed the stairs, and he gave her a hug of thankfulness before going into his room. Deidre listened to the radio during her drive to the BCA. She made the same trip so often it was becoming routine, and by 9 she was walking into the central office. She needed no introduction. The receptionist recognized her instantly and ushered her into Melissa's office. "Good to see you made the trip safe and sound," the detective greeted her. "The director, Aaron Goodman, is waiting for us next door. She's a great boss. I'm sure you'll enjoy meeting her." Melissa walked out of the room and motioned for Deidre to follow. She knocked on an office 2 doors down the hall from her own. "Come on in," Deidre heard the alto voice call out from inside the office. Melissa opened the door, and they were met by a burly figure. Aaron grabbed Deidre's hand and shook it. "You must be Deidre. I wanted to meet you for the longest time. Here, take a seat and let's talk." She swung a chair away from the wall with one hand and plunked it down for Deidre, who was rather awed by the larger-than-life presence of her new boss. "I've read your report of finding the frozen body of a girl under a bridge in Silver Bay," Aaron began with no preamble. "I also read Dr. Coster's report of her examination of the victim. This has the makings of something the media would consider sensational. It'd sell a lot of papers and airtime. Let's try to get it wrapped up before that happens. Now, Deidre, I've already done some footwork from my end. Dr. Coster implied the victim may be of First Nation descent," she expounded, using the preferred term of the Indigenous Canadian people. Specifically, she indicated Cree. "Judy is seldom far off the course, so this is where I want you to begin." Before Deidre could respond, Aaron continued in her commanding voice. "We ran her fingerprints through our database and drew a blank. DNA takes a little longer to work with, but in a few days we'll have results on those tests as well. I suspect that won't help us ID her either if she's from Canada. So here's where you'll begin. I spoke with the Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe Aski Nation, Henry Musio. Here is the address of his office." She handed a piece of paper to Deidre, who noted the city was Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. "The Anishinaabe are Cree and have an excellent social organization. Their police system is second to none. Henry's phone number is at the bottom of the page. Call him when you are ready, which I'm assuming will be day after tomorrow, and he'll have the head of the force's guns and gangs unit present for your meeting. As of now, we're going to concentrate on finding the identity of our victim, and you're going to start by following Dr. Coster's supposition that she's Cree. If that turns up nothing in a few days, then we'll get our heads together and find other threads to follow. Do you have any questions?" Before Deidre could even shake her head, Aaron said, "Good. Now if you'll excuse me, I have a meeting with the state attorney general." Melissa took the cue and got up from her chair. Deidre followed suit, but as they were leaving, Aaron's parting shot was, "Oh, and Deidre, good to have you on our team." As soon as they were out of earshot, Deidre turned to Melissa. "Is she always like that?" Melissa laughed and put her arm around her colleague's shoulder. "Sometimes she's more abrupt." "Don't worry, I could tell she likes you. If you ever need someone in your corner, Aaron's the person you want there. She'll defend you to the last man standing and still have the energy to make sure you're okay. Believe me." Deidre shrugged, accepting what Melissa said, but she knew Aaron would accept nothing but her best and would want results yesterday, if not sooner. "Come on, it's lunchtime. Let's collect Judy from her lab and grab a bite to eat. Seems the three of us do our best work over food." And she grabbed Deidre's elbow, leading her down the hall. "Something tells me we're going to be seeing quite a bit of each other over the next several weeks. By the way, Aaron gave me some directives to pass on to you. She spoke to the Lake County Sheriff this morning before you arrived. Your office will be set up in the Lake County Law Enforcement Center next to the courthouse. By tomorrow morning, a private phone line will have been installed. You'll have a secretary, Jill Dobers, I believe is her name, who starts work the day you do. Also, you'll have your own fax machine, copy machine, and computer. As you can probably guess, Aaron wants you on the job tomorrow morning at 7 and wants a meeting set up with the Grand Chief for Friday. That shouldn't be difficult to arrange. She's already done the groundwork, and he is expecting your call. An official SUV has been delivered to Two Harbors, and you have a designated parking spot. By the way, you do have a passport, don't you? Deirdre's head was spinning because of the pace at which everything was happening, but she had enough sense left to nod an affirmative. By the time they had arrived at Judy's office, she stepped out to greet them. Hey, thanks for giving me a heads up. I have my desk cleared, at least temporarily. So let's go. The three women made their way to a cafeteria that served several office buildings in close proximity. Deirdre looked outside as they traversed a skywalk and was grateful they didn't have to brave the mid-November cold. The temperature hovered around the 10-degree mark, and a stiff wind blew from the Canadian northwest. At this rate, it was going to be a long winter. They moved through the assembly-lined cafeteria, selecting what suited their tastes, and after finding a table in a somewhat secluded spot, they settled in to fill their bellies. "I have no other findings to give you," Judy announced. "I wish I had better news, but we have a few things to go on. I'd bet my next paycheck I'm right about the girl's ethnicity. Hope you get some results in your search." For the rest of the time, the three talked about non-forensic topics: how their jobs were going, if the legislature was going to come through with funding for their department, how their personal lives were playing out. Deirdre, Judy wanted to know, "Any man in your life since we last visited?" She laughed as Deirdre's face turned red. "Even if there was, I don't think I'd tell you two gossips," she laughed and winked at Melissa. Too soon, their meal was over, and Deirdre headed up I-35 toward Duluth. She was so lost in thought that before she realized it, she was at the crest of Thompson Hill, more than 600 feet above the freshwater ports of Duluth Superior. The frigid November air was perfectly clear, and she took in the panorama of lights laid out in perfect squares of city streets. Red dots, taillights of cars, moved at what seemed a snail's pace far below. The arch of the Blatnik Bridge was clearly visible, with its span delineated by halogen lighting, and ships were lit up like Christmas trees as they sat in their berths, waiting to be loaded with iron ore pellets, grain, or containers destined for overseas cities. Deirdre never ceased being surprised by the grandeur of the sight. In little more than a mile, the road descended to lake level, and she made her way through Duluth in short order, stopping at Ben's long enough to pick up Pete. 20 miles later, she was in Two Harbors, still 40 minutes from her cabin in the woods. It dawned on her this was never going to work. She'd have to move back to Two Harbors until her assignment was over, a thought that troubled her a great deal. By the time she reached home, it was 10:30 at night, and she stood outside her cabin, looking at the stars and soaking in the magnitude of what she too often took for granted. After a few moments, the chill of the night filtered through her winter jacket, and she was forced to go inside. "Come on, Pete, time to get the place heated up. We've got a lot of work waiting for us." Pete cocked his head to one side and looked at her as though he understood. Chapter 9. Deirdre's alarm rang at 5:30 a.m. She pried her eyelids open, but when she threw the covers back, she found that the wood stove had not had time to burn itself out. The floor around it was still toasty against her feet. She didn't bother to put another stick of wood in its firebox. She would be out of the door by the time the cabin cooled off. She dressed and didn't time to make a cup of coffee, thinking she'd stop at the convenience store in Silver Bay to save time. She arrived at her office in Two Harbors before 7. On the first floor of the law enforcement center, toward the back, it looked as if someone had cleaned out a storage closet to make room for her. Two desks cluttered the small space, evidently one for her and one for her secretary, Jill. On a stand in the corner sat a fax machine/copy machine. There were no windows. Deirdre felt sorry for Jill, who would spend the great majority of her time in the cubicle-sized space. At least Deirdre would be out in the field most of the time, but everyone had their own problems to deal with, she thought. Nevertheless, she would remember to be extra considerate of Jill's situation. As she was arranging items on her desk, her secretary reported for work. She walked in unannounced, her rainbow-dyed hair in a flyaway mess, and extended her hand to Deirdre. "Jill Dobers, your secretary. You must be Deirdre. I've heard so many good things about you and have been looking forward to working for you since they assigned me this job. Now, what can I do to get us started?" Deirdre hadn't given the subject one thought. "Gosh, I'm afraid I have nothing for you to do yet. I just got here myself and have nothing organized." Jill looked around. "Well, for starters, we need a coffee pot. Regular or decaf?" "Regular." "Good. If we're not going to get a charge out of it, why bother?" Okay, what's the most pressing thing on your plate this morning? Deirdre thought for a moment. I have to organize my desk, then make some kind of living arrangement for myself while I'm on this case. After that, I have to call the Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe Aski Nation in Thunder Bay to set up an appointment to meet with him and the head of their guns and gangs unit tomorrow. If I can get that much done today, I'll be lucky. Jill looked around the room again. Leave the organization to me. You get yourself situated as far as living accommodations are concerned. When you get back, I'll have made your appointment with the chief. Deirdre looked at her, shocked at the woman's efficiency. It was only 7:15, and already she felt like something good was going to happen. Well, don't just stand there. I've got things to do, Jill said, asserting her secretarial authority. All Deirdre could do was leave the office. She checked upstairs, hoping her friend Jeff was done with his morning report session. He was, and when he saw her enter the outer office, he rushed to give her a hug. Deirdre, you don't know how good this makes me feel. It hasn't been the same since you left. Everybody says so. It's good to have you back in the building. I've got some things for you. Jeff motioned for her to follow him into his office. Have a seat for a minute or two. He reached into his desk and grabbed a set of keys. BCA dropped these off yesterday. The SUV is out back. It's black and has the agency logo stenciled on its side doors. Also, they left a credit card for your use to charge gas, lodging, meals, and anything else pertaining to your investigation. Make sure you give Jill all your receipts. She'll tally them and send them in for you. Here are your credentials, he said as he handed her a badge and an ID tag. There was a handwritten note with the ID. Didn't have time to get these to you yesterday. Took the picture off your records. Hope it's okay. Good hunting. Aaron Goodman. Deirdre smiled at the curtness of the note, and she could picture Aaron hurriedly scribbling it on a piece of paper. Jeff, I hope this job is short-lived. I don't know if you have much information about what we found under that bridge in Silver Bay, but we need to get to the bottom of this as soon as possible. It's the worst-case scenario you can imagine. Jeff's face told her he knew. I'm glad you're the one working this, was all he said. Deirdre stood to excuse herself, and Jeff looked her square in the eye. I mean what I said. The SUV was out back, just as Jeff said it would be, and Deirdre crawled into the driver's seat, adjusted the mirrors, and turned the key. She hoped the vehicle's heater was a good one. Leaving the parking lot, she turned right and then left onto Waterfront Drive, continued to Highway 61, then turned left. She was heading to her old neighborhood on 9th Avenue. When she reached 7th Street, she turned down a familiar alley and pulled up behind Inga Olson's house. It had been over a year since the two of them had visited. As she walked up the shoveled walkway, she glanced at the house next door, her house, the one in which John had been gunned down.
You've been listening to episode 4 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading. So be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors here on Literally from the North Shore.